This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to visit with a brilliant leader, Sanjula Jain. Sanjula is Senior Vice President of Market Strategy and the Chief Research Officer at Trilliant Health. She's also a PhD. She's brilliant and spent time at Rice, at Emory, and also at Johns Hopkins as an adjunct professor, assistant adjunct professor. She'll tell us more about it. What we're going to talk about today is post-COVID, if we hopefully get there and not too long, post-COVID recovery, and what health systems need to do about the changing health economy as we sort of move forward. Sanjula, Dr. Jain, can you take a moment to tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Trilliant Health?
Absolutely. Well, first off, Scott, thanks for having me. I'm really a health economist, health services researcher by training. So somehow found my way into industry as really kind of the resident academic, if you will. But what I have done across my career and what I continue to do at Trilliant is finding ways to take all the noise and change that's happening across the healthcare ecosystem, from policy to provider trends to digital health, and tell data stories and just try to help individuals, and particularly, you know, C-suite decision makers, think 5 to 10 years out. What should they be preparing for? So Trilliant Health, that's kind of where I'm spending most of my time these days. Trilliant Health really is a predictive analytics organization that health systems, but also payers, pharma, other companies make evidence-based decisions. And we do that through a variety of analytics and predictive modeling tools. And I have the pleasure of really heading up the research, thought leadership, and content strategy. So that is really what that boils down to, is building a think tank within the organization to just help translate all the different change and data and help us kind of make sense of it as an industry.
So interesting. And talk for a moment about, you've talked about the idea of the U.S. health economy, and that makes great sense to me, given that it's 20% of the whole economy and it's bigger than most countries, the health economy itself. Talk for a moment about, can you describe what you mean by it and what it all means to our listeners to think about it as a U.S. health economy?
So the use of that term is intentional because I think for starters, we have a really bad habit in healthcare of thinking in silos, right? So all of us on the provider side, working with hospitals and health systems, we really think about us as, you know, the provider economy. And then we think about pharma and payers. And so really starting point is the health economy. It's nearly $4 trillion. It's the largest sector of the largest global economy for the United States. Within that, hospitals are really the largest segment of that economy. And I wanted to use that term, and we publish a lot of research with this framework, because as healthcare continues to grow and we have what I'll call new entrants and non-traditional players enter healthcare, how we operate can't be restricted to traditional healthcare thinking. It really has to be like other economies and thinking from an economic perspective. And maybe I'm biased as a health economist in that, but we have to start thinking like consumer industries and retail industries and all of these other industries really think in economic terms. And it comes down to the fundamental rules of supply, demand, and yield. And so that's really kind of the conceptual framework that I encourage really anyone who touches healthcare to think about is, do I understand what demand is for whether it's my service or broadly, what is the supply in my market for that? And then as a consequence, then how does that affect the yield in terms of utilization and subsequent price? So just as a quick anecdote, and I'm sure you see a lot of this too, but one of the things I see in particular health systems underestimate when they don't think economically is they always underestimate their market share because they don't actually have a way to quantify and measure the true supply in their markets. We have a tendency, right, to think, oh, or the other suppliers are a couple of the small physician groups and the big other, health system brands in my market. But there's so much more to this story. So I think every strategy, situation, issue in healthcare can be looked at from the vantage point of supply, demand, and yield.
Fantastic. And such a fascinating time to talk about those issues as you see looming doctor shortages, provider shortages, nursing shortages that have caused huge dollar impact on staffing budgets and so forth for systems, and so many longer term trends and issues and things moving towards consumer and so forth. Talk a little bit about some of the trends that you're watching and maybe some of the trends that are overlooked, that people, obviously the shortage of nurses and doctors is right in our face. What are some of the trends you're watching, some that are looked at, some that are overlooked, and things we should be thinking about?
Absolutely. So I think the starting point is there's so many anecdotes that I am always amazed that just have been ingrained in us as an industry for the last 30 to 40 years that I would say aren't true. So some of those things include the concept of, we tend to think in healthcare, our patients are loyal to us as providers, right? So if they come to my health system, if a patient comes to my health system, then they will probably continue coming to me. Well, the reality is, back to the economic principles and thinking like a consumer economy, patients are consumers, and consumers are by definition not loyal. And so as a fun data point, one thing to think about is, on average, patients across the country, consumers across the country, I should say, go to about 4.2 provider brands. So that includes your health systems or a individual physician group in a given year, which is not atypical when you compare that to other industries like grocery brands, or think about streaming services, right? How many of us subscribe to Netflix and YouTube and Amazon Video, right? We all have multiple things that we subscribe to and purchase our goods from. So healthcare is no different. But I think that concept of consumer brand splitting and loyalty is really something that we don't talk enough about, right? Because we've been primed to think about HCAHPS and net promoter score. And so that's one trend that I think we are really missing the mark on today. And that's really going to be telling going forward. We can talk more about that a little later. Another one is this concept of kind of, if you build it, I'm kind of thinking acutely for hospitals and health systems where, if we build something, whether it's an urgent care, primary care clinic, the patients and consumers will come. Well, I think we would all agree at this face value, but we don't practice it, is this idea that consumers make decisions not only based off their healthcare needs, but their psychology, right? What are their individual preferences? Who are the people that like to have a sticky relationship with their primary care doctor versus those who are in the moment, I'm kind of living in the here and now, and so I'm going to go to urgent care if and when I need to, versus those who are willing to drive an extra hour just to go to what they perceive to be the name brand entity. So there's so much behind decision making at the individual consumer level that I think we misunderstand and don't think a lot about. And then, I think broadly back to the health economy framework, really there's so many trends to unpack, but demand for healthcare services is basically flat to declining. And I think that is one thing that we have for so long. We all make budget decisions and we always assume, okay, annual growth, right? Like 3%, we're going to see growth in utilization and volume, all that. Well, that's definitely not true. And demand varies regionally, no doubt. Supply is rapidly growing. And so, in some extent, really, supply exceeds the demand for services today. And then, as we all know, yields, the prices that we're operating within that supply and demand construct are just purely unsustainable. So, Scott, we could probably spend a couple of hours digging into a lot of those subtrends within that. But if I had to distill it down, it would really be, I think, the fact that demand is flat to declining is something that really influences anything we might think about in healthcare.
But talk about that for a moment, because that's a fascinating point. I mean, there's two of those points I want to cover with you for a moment, Dr. Jane. First is this concept. Just was written that the cost per individual in the country is now $6,000 a person for healthcare. So for a family of four, it's $24,000, whatever the number is. But the fascinating footnote to that was, it was the slowest growth in that in a long time. Does that mean that demand is tempering, even though we see so much healthcare costs and so many challenges and an aging population? Does that mean that demand is actually starting to taper off just a little bit? What's your sense of that? Then I want to talk about hospitals are trying so hard to stay so consumer-centric at a time when consumers are more informed and more willing to move their behaviors. Just maybe go one bit deeper on those two issues that you mentioned.
So on the demand part, and I'd be happy to share this with you, we actually just published a study that has a bunch of data on this point. So for starters, demand has actually been declining since 2008. And you can look at that just if you look at hospital inpatient admission data, right? It's been flat and declining across the country for years. Now, when you actually compound that and think further out and you run some of the models and look at future demand, and that's a function of, during COVID, right? A lot of folks moved to different geographies. You factor in their psychology of preferences. you factor in just incidence of disease and care trends and all of that, and look at that in aggregate. And you, when you actually forecast that out, you start seeing that demand in certain geographies is, you know, staying about flat. So I would say the Sun Belt area, right? So states like Texas and Florida and Arizona, right? They're seeing growth in demand. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One being just population growth, right? There's a lot more individuals, consumers moving down to those areas. And a lot of them tend to be commercially insured in a certain age demographic. So they're driving some of that demand. But on the whole, right, comparative to what it was years ago, it is still lower than what our hospitals and health systems have been used to operating. You contrast that with other markets like Chicago, where you are, right? Demand is forecasted to go down more so than others. And so the point being is it has been going down, and it's just not a trend that I think has received a lot of attention. And so that's why I spent a lot of my time trying to actually show that data and make it real for people at the market level, because I think looking at anything nationally is not helpful and it's not telling. And you know, you could look at demand by services. So we're actually working on a study this week looking at women's health. So demand for certain OBGYN services, right, at the procedure service level varies drastically than demand for cardiovascular services. So as a whole, yeah, demand generally is going down. There are obviously exceptions and pockets to that, but that's the point is we're artificially inflating prices and things like that at some of the historical levels, assuming that level of demand, when really demand has gone down. And the other component to that is, you know, in basics of economics, when the supply is so great, right, there's so many more providers and suppliers today than there were years ago. So inherently, when you've got low demand and high supply, I mean, prices have to go down, right? Like the market and consumers will not tolerate that. And so that's a little bit of the tipping point we're at right now, where that's why traditional providers, hospitals and health systems are at a fundamental disadvantage. And back to your earlier question on why the health economy, it's because every other new entrant like Walmart and Amazon, they're thinking like the health economy, right? They know that they can do high volume, low price goods at, you know, commodity type prices, and they track economic principles. It's the traditional provider market that doesn't really operate that way.
Just fascinating, actually. And as you see this consumerization and digitization and the impact that it has on these big standing health systems, and they're trying to maintain their patients, what a fascinating thing to watch and maintain their consumer centricity in their local markets and their broader markets. It's a fascinating thing to watch. And your point on demand tapering in some areas while growing in other areas is well stated. Let's talk about this, Dr. Jane. The rebound from the pandemic is not over yet. We're still trying to figure this out. How will the pandemic have shaped what the health economy looks like once we find a new normal and equilibrium? What's that going to look like? And are there opportunities for health system executives coming out of the pandemic?
Definitely. I mean, Scott, what I would tell you is, I mean, a lot of what we've talked about still holds in the post-pandemic, you know, economy, right? So even when you look at demand, actually, I know there's some assumptions people think, oh, you know, demand is going to go up, you know, post-pandemic. Actually, we've done the modeling, the demand forecast kind of pre-COVID, post-COVID don't drastically change. And I'll spare everyone kind of the methodological kind of nuances of explaining why that is. But you know, really, as we think about planning for the future and how to be better prepared, I would go back to the basics. So what are the trends that link it back to the consumer? What do the consumers actually, what are their preferences? What are the care modalities that they like and prefer, and how does that vary? And that's what we need to be thinking about. And the only way to have that baseline is to measure it. So telehealth is a great example, right? So everybody, it's no surprise that we saw this rapid spike in adoption during the pandemic. Great. Now, but what nobody is talking about is how prevalent is that trend from a consumer perspective? So a lot of the data that we see kind of floating around in the headlines is actually focused on visit volumes. But when you look at the unique number of Americans who used telehealth during the peak of the pandemic, which I would argue is really kind of this forced adoption period, right? So if you didn't use telehealth in 2020 like the chance of you kind of using it today, like it, you're not as incentivized to do that as you were last year. Well, it turns out about 13 million Americans generated about 100 million visits during the pandemic. So let that sit in for a second, because that's a trend that nobody is talking about, right? It's the law of small numbers. And so then you start unpacking that. Okay, so who are those 13 million Americans? Well, most of them tend to be commercially insured women. Then there's all this discussion on the policy side about, well, you know, what about Medicaid and Medicare? What if we expanded access to, you know, audio? Well, you know, there's a bunch of data. When you start peeling back the layers, you start seeing, well, actually, consumers don't love telehealth as much as we all think they do, right? Some of it might have been necessity in a moment of time, but there's only certain segments of the population that like it and will continue to use it moving forward. There are others that truly want to come in person. There are others that will go to an urgent care first, right? We have to start thinking about the preferences of the consumer, not in terms of the historical utilization, but also like them as individual psychology, right? And there's a bunch of work we do that is looking at, you know, the profile, a psychographic profile of an individual consumer, and how that's more predictive than demographics for when and where and how an individual consumes care. So that's a long-winded way of saying, Scott, that I think as we prepare for the future, health systems really need to think hard and really quantify who their consumers are. What are their preferences? What are they doing today? But then what, more importantly, what are they going to do 3 to 5 years out, and actually model out those scenarios in an evidence-based way? Because otherwise we're just making decisions based off assumptions and gut. And that's not going to work when you're going against Amazon and Walmart, who have data on their consumers, and they know every single thing about what they're going to do, and they can influence their choices.
It's truly fascinating, right? I mean, because what happens is, if you could really digest and figure out the data around your area and what it might look like, what the opportunities are, you may have imperfect solutions, but you're way, way, way ahead of the curve of somebody who's doing it anecdotally based on top of mind, sitting in a room without that kind of deeper data and information. Is that a fair statement, Dr. Jane?
Yeah, if I'm understanding what you're saying, I mean, this idea of we have just been, I think there's a lot of assumptions that haven't been backed by data that we have not asked ourselves, like, why is that, right? And so whether it's people assuming, I'll simplify it. So people assume that demand for service is inherently going to go up because they see, oh, well, obesity and diabetes is going up. And the World Health Organization told us that. So inherently, we're going to see a one-to-one increase. Well, that math actually doesn't quite work out that way. Or people assume, right, the mom comes in to deliver a baby, and we're going to have this great care experience, and we're going to make the labor and delivery ward look really beautiful, then, you know, because they make most of the decisions for their family, they're of course going to come back to our organization for all subsequent care. Well, no, actually, it turns out that women as consumers are less loyal to provider networks than men are, because they're more in the, they're shopping around, and they're going to go to whatever care setting makes sense in time of need for their family, right? There's just so much that we have not really thought about in terms of what is real for my market versus your market versus what actually is a national trend. And I would argue that we have a tendency to make decisions based off things that we believe to be true for, let's just say, 100% of the population, which may only be true for 15 to 20% of the population. And telehealth is one of those examples.
But that's a brilliant perspective. What you're really saying is better data is going to lead to better strategy and better decisions. I mean, and that seems to make a ton of sense versus the anecdotal, oh, there's a ton of need for this, so this is going to happen with that. Whereas we invest in this, this will happen. You're much more likely to make better decisions with better data. And that's what Trillions helps with. Is that a fair statement? Better data is going to lead to better strategy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would say that we are at a point in the industry where if health systems don't start applying that type of thinking and leveraging the data to make those decisions, it's game over, quite frankly, because, you know, to quote Peter Drucker, I mean, the hospital unit is really the most complex kind of organization in any economy, really. And so when traditional providers are going up against the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world, hospitals are inherently in a negative sum game. And so to compete, I mean, really what Trilliant does is we are trying to help traditional providers compete because the game is getting a lot more complicated, right? Because it goes back to the economic principle. If demand's going down, supply is going up, fighting and earning that consumer loyalty and in effect their share of care is going to be infinitely harder. And if health systems can't figure out how to influence those choices, plan appropriately, anticipate and predict the future to make those right decisions, it's not going to work. We're already seeing a lot of those pressures on hospitals and health systems. And so they fundamentally have to rethink their approach and do things differently than they have in the past.
But your point is so well taken. You've seen so many systems, so many provider organizations make bad choices based on anecdotal thoughts. Like, we're going to build a heart hospital without really studying what are the real trends in open heart surgery that turned into stents versus open heart surgery. So people at all these heart hospitals ended up in trouble with them. The home health benefit was added 100 years ago. The government thought it would save money. Of course, better data would have showed, no, of course it's not going to save money, but it might still be a very good thing. And people building all these satellite facilities based on population growth, but not really studying the population growth and how long it would take to fill up a facility 20 miles away that is growing, but slow growth. I mean, there's so many spots where better data could have led to better decisions. And that's where Trilliant really comes into play, both defining what to do and what not to do. As, you know, as Peter Drucker would have said, some of the most brilliant choices are choosing what not to do and what to do. And so just a fascinating perspective. Dr. Jane, what other things should our listeners be thinking about or considering as they look at sort of the new health economy and making better decisions? Because that's what it's all about. As a leader, better people, better decisions. I mean, those concepts, tell us what else we should be thinking about.
You know, I can't emphasize enough, Scott, this concept of, you know, when we think about any strategy that we're going to deploy going forward, to always come back to that supply, demand, yield construct, right? So in your last remarks, you know, the real-time example of that, you know, our team was just working with the system on basically site selection. And so you have a large health system that's, you know, purchased a piece of land and they're saying, great, you know, we want to build an urgent care center, right? We think that that's what the market needs and that's the consumer-friendly thing to do. Well, it turns out when you run that market data, not just historical data, but then you start modeling out the next 5 to 10 years and think about migration changes, and more importantly, the psychology of the consumers living in that market, it turned out that when you paired the kind of consumer mix, both demographics, psychographics, disease incidence, but then also the supply of what was already in that market from a, you know, was the primary care supply underserved or overserved? And you start putting all these forces together. The recommendation for that organization was actually, you need to build a freestanding orthopedic center because your only way to influence consumers in your market and their choices against your competitors and emerging competitors is this, right? And that may seem really simple, but when you look at the data and look at that supply, demand, yield interplay, that's what it comes down to. And so what I, you know, leave you with is using that conceptual framework as a guidepost, but then always bringing it back to the consumer. I think we have to start thinking like every other industry. And so I'll give the grocery store analogy. The grocery store business knows, you know, I'm in Florida today. So I like to get my routine groceries at Publix, but I also shop at Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, right? So I split my grocery shopping across, you know, 3 to 4 brands. But every one of those grocery stores has a bunch of data on me as a consumer. They know exactly what things I like to buy from their store versus other stores, and they automatically assume that I'm a disloyal consumer. So what do? They start influencing my choices to increase my share of spend within their stores based off my unique preferences. So they know that if I go to Whole Foods and let's just say that's where I buy my alternative milks, right? Like they're going to really try to cater to my preferences and in non-dairy alternatives, which is different. And they're not going to try to influence my choices for getting my produce there, right? It might seem like a silly example, but we have to start thinking in healthcare that the consumer has a lot of choice today. And we have so long said, well, you know, even if they go to Walmart, it's, you know, a low margin thing. It's basic primary care. They still have to come to the hospital for high margin, more serious care. Well, we can't think like that anymore. We have to think, what do we know about our consumers, those that we see today, but also how can we attract new consumers and influence them to bring that brand loyalty and start catering to their preferences in an evidence-based way, and recognize that not all consumers are going to be ideal consumers or customers for that particular organization. So I think this consumer at the middle, like, we, you know, that is something we've been talking about in boardrooms for the last decade, right? Like, we're going to be more patient friendly, consumer friendly, and we've had all these point solutions. I think what I would encourage everyone to think about is, how do you know if that's working? How do you distill all those pieces together to say, have you earned the consumer's loyalty? When you, it's not HCAP, it's not if they're satisfied, it's where do they actually come for their care? Do they come to your brand? Why or why not? And how will you continue to influence those choices in an economy that has a lot more choice and a lot of competition, and that competition will continue to grow?
Just magnificent. So many of the things that you say resonate, and so important to have the right data to make these choices, not be dealing with sort of like anachronistic, sort of like intuition in the boardroom, intuition at the C-suite, but really to have some data to back that up and to look at it and to be open about it. Fascinating example about the urgent care. Fascinating. When I'm in Florida, I am truly just Publix. And you are, like you said, a woman and a much more thoughtful consumer. So it's Publix, Whole Foods, and Trader Joe's. It's really a fascinating discussion of behavioral health as well as the health economy. Dr. Chang, what a pleasure to visit with you. What a great learning experience for myself and our producer, Milena, today. What a pleasure. I know our audience will love it. Dr. Chang, thank you so much for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be with you.